To introduce myself, I'm Alison Donnelly. I am a Payment Services Regulation Specialist and a Director at FSCom, the Compliance Consultancy, but I have the really big privilege of being the Ambassador for the European Women in Payments Network to Ireland. And it's been a real pleasure over the last year or so to host a few events, a few networking events. In the olden days, we had them in person, and now, of course, we're doing these remote events. And it's been great getting to know so many people in the sector. One of the things that I really love about the European Women in Payments Network is it is genuinely European wide. And so I think even today, we have some people who are joining us from payment sectors in other jurisdictions, which is brilliant as well. So to explain what we're going to do today, we are going to, first of all, have a fireside chat between myself and Carol, where I'm going to ask her some, well, my pressing questions. I'm really looking forward to that. That's this session, this part of it's going to be recorded so that we can share it with other people who haven't been able to join us today. After that, halfway through, we're going to switch off the recording and we'll switch on our cameras. And we're hoping to try and replicate a sort of more of a networking event that like we used to have in the olden days. And so we're opening it up to questions. So if you've got some great questions that I haven't covered in the first half, please do note them down and ask them directly to Carol after in the second half. So, without further ado, why don't I introduce Carol and ask her, well, actually, why don't I let you, Carol, to introduce yourself? You'll be much better at putting across who you are and what you are. Carol.
Well, thank you so much, Alison. I am delighted to be here. So thank you for having me and welcome everyone who's taken time out of their busy Thursday. It's a pleasure to be here and tell you a little bit of our story at Esther. So, as you said, my name is Carol Rossborough. I'm co-founder and CEO of Esther. My wonderful and very gifted business partner is currently on maternity leave, Eilish McCall. So she isn't with us today. But she is a large part of the reason why we got started. So I do like to give her a fair amount of credit. How we got started with Esther was a relationship between Eilish and I. It was a friendship. We got to know each other and we thought, you know, let's see what we can do in terms of a charity product. Initially, the concept was mine. I wrote it down in a white paper. And then through Catalyst and co-founders, we jumped into a co-founders course. And then from there, we launched into a pilot. And that was about 2 years ago. And so that's how we got it started. We are a peer-to-peer giving platform, allowing people who want to help to give charitable donations directly to people who are in need. What makes this different is that this is hyper-local, very targeted person-to-person giving. So that's who I am, and that's a little bit about Esther in a nutshell.
Thank you, Carol. Carol, I'm a payments person first and foremost, so I'm going to have to ask you the nuts and bolts of the payments. So how do you do this? How do you connect the people and how do you make the payments happen?
Brilliant. Well, the two questions that we get asked are, am I anonymous as a donor? Because we do talk a lot about connection between people. Ultimately, that's what is at the core of our brand, is about journeying with somebody in need and connection. So the algorithm does match you directly with someone, but you're both anonymous. So the recipient's anonymous and you're anonymous. And our charity partners, we work very closely with charity partners, and they register people in need within the community. So that's kind of how the connection works. The payment part is quite unique to Esther in terms of our charitable product. And it's a very exciting solution. So what we do is we switch off high-risk merchants on a prepaid card. So things like off-licenses, gambling, casinos, some online purchases, and even cash withdrawal if it's for a specific program type that is vulnerable people, like someone who's sleeping rough on the streets. And what we're able to do is give these cards to people who are in poverty within a city. And so they're able to receive donations directly onto a prepaid card, and then they get to spend that as they need to spend it. And so for example, if you take someone, one of the ladies on our program that we speak about often is Joanne. And Joanne is a young mom. She's 34. She lives in the centre of Belfast. Joanne isn't her real name to protect her identity, but she has four children. She lives in a two-bedroom terraced house with no back garden. And Joanne relies very heavily on food banks. So she tries very hard to budget and really save her money. She's been with our charity partner for a very long time, who've taken her through counselling and budgeting courses and trying to help her to cook good meals from scratch. But quite often what happens is Joanne will be doing really well, and then all of a sudden she'll be hit with a crisis, like her boiler goes, or her car needs about £600 or £700 worth of work done to it. And things like this that we experience in our own lives, your washing machine breaks and things like that. And all of a sudden, she doesn't have the money to make ends meet, and she falls back into debt again. And so she is in this cycle of poverty. Now, what we're able to do with Joanne is she's registered by our charity, and then we're able to issue her with an Esther card. What that does for somebody like Joanne is twofold. It really gives her so much dignity as a young mother that she isn't having to go into a charity and receive a food bag every week. A food bag with food that maybe doesn't suit her needs or her children's needs, but it's just been put together by someone who is taking charitable food donations. So that's the first thing. So she knows she's dependent upon this charity. So we're able to allow her to take that donation and go to Tesco and buy her own groceries. So there's immediately this feeling of dignity and empowerment. The second thing with the card solution is that because we're able to switch off some high-risk merchant codes, this is less likely to be taken off her by someone within her family who's a gambler, someone who potentially has an addiction, and potentially even herself if she's been through that journey in her own life. It's much less likely to trigger binge drinking or an addiction of any description. Not that Joanne has those vulnerabilities, but it just protects that donation for her specific needs, to allow her to buy groceries. You know, she can spend it on utility bills, she can use it for school uniforms, she can use it for taxi transport if she needs, if her car is out of order. And so she has a wide range of choice, but also with this safeguarding in place. And we work really hard to figure out, well, you know, what is the level of safeguarding that we should put in place for Joanne. And we've kind of done a bit of research on the donor side of things, and we've done some research with the charity and recipients like Joanne, and we found a middle ground that she's delighted with, and also the donors are happy with as well. So it's peer-to-peer giving, but with the peace of mind that when you do donate to someone in need, that it's most likely to be spent on something helpful. So that's where the payment part of it comes in.
So, I mean, oh, there's so many questions from that. So, first of all, you know, I like the idea that you get to choose, well, not choose, maybe not choose, but you're connected with somebody with a real story to it. Yeah. But there's also a burden with that. Am I the only person, if I signed up, am I the only person supporting Joanne? What if I have a bad month and can't support her to the extent that I thought I could?
Yeah, and that's something that we did really early research on, and we heard that a lot, Alison, so I don't think you're on your own with that sort of, is this now my burden? Is her life now my burden? It's usually about 10 donors to one person, depending on the donation amount. So you're definitely not on your own. So the burden is most definitely not on you. And I think that was something we realized quite early on, is that people wanted to help, but they didn't want to feel entirely responsible for one particular person. So there's a couple of different options in terms of the donation choices on the platform. You can choose to entirely support one person if that's your desire, but also you can choose to give a once-off donation or for your donation to be kind of put into a pot and spread out among the program. So maybe 10 or 15 people in one group with one particular charity partner, and you can donate to that then is kind of dispersed out onto those cards. We try to give our donors choice to how much connection do they want, how much responsibility, I suppose, and how much responsibility do they want to take on. The other thing that we're very aware of is that there's a lot of people out there who don't want to journey with someone in need. they sort of trust that we do what we do well, and they're happy to give on a monthly basis, and then they'll unsubscribe from our communication regarding Joanne or you know, John, who's rough sleeping and trying to get his asylum status. So there are people who really want that story and that connection, and then there are certain people who said, look, I have enough going on. I'm delighted to help, but I don't want to have that connection. So, and I think it's a very personal choice as well.
That's interesting that you can, yeah, that you find that in both ways, and I can see both angles there. It was interesting what you were saying as well about the card, being able to go into Tesco's and pay with your contactless card like everybody else does, rather than having to fish out tokens or something that would be, you know, potential for stigmatizing. But I was also wondering, how does the card look? Is it branded as Esther? Because I would kind of imagine that might be the sort of flaw in the sort of overall design later on down the line.
Great point. No, because our brand is very kind of brash. It's quite sort of pink and, you know, very sort of empowering feminism. So we do have this like great big pink Esther logo, which most certainly is not on our cards. We work with a third party provider called Expend, and what they do for us is they just take all the brand off. So it doesn't have any brand on it. It is just a MasterCard, and it's contactless. You can use chip and pin with it. But yeah, the last thing we want is for someone to be recognized as an Esther recipient. So our focus in terms of the end product for the recipient is always about dignity, choice, and empowerment, that she feels supported, but also that she's in charge of her own life and she has that sense of independence as well.
And this is, I heard you saying Joanne was in Belfast, and I know Belfast to begin with, but I think you've got plans to go broader.
We certainly do. So we're in the middle of chats with a brilliant homeless charity in London, and also a charity within Denver. And those are the two projects we're looking to branch out into right now. So the solution in Denver looks a little bit different because, I mean, the whole payment system is very, very different. It's completely unique to the US. You know, UK fintech and US fintech, as you know, are very different in terms of everything, regulation, money transfer, license, the whole lot. So London is the much easier step for us because we can stay with the same card provider and, you know, it's the same currency. It's just really straightforward. But also we are, as quickly as we can, wanting to move into the US market. So Denver is specifically looking at the homeless population. They have a big homeless problem. And a lot of what we're doing in Denver is lump sum to start with, you know, getting people into rehab and then helping them into subsidized housing. So in the initial phases of the Denver pilot, we're not actually using a card solution. It will only be about 6 to 8 months in that we will then start looking at getting those people who've been through rehab, been through subsidized housing, who then need to start paying their own bills again. And we'll probably put a card solution in place for the donations after that. So each geography we move into will look slightly different in terms of the product offering. London is very easy for us to kind of move across there and start working with the homeless population there.
It's interesting you mention fintech, because fintech, paytech, the charity sector clearly. And I think also from reading your website that, you know, there's the origins of the idea, the concept came out of tech, and I think there's maybe even a blockchain mention in there.
Yeah. So,
What sector do you feel like you fall into? And is it important to fall into one particular tribe as opposed to another?
That is like the most haunting question. And it's something I have thought long and hard about. Are we fintech? Are we in the charity sector? Are we a social enterprise? And to be honest, I think we fit quite comfortably across different sectors, which maybe is unique. We utilize the very best parts of certain sectors, and we bring these sectors together to work in collaboration with each other to solve a problem. So, and I think as we look at, you know, the future of work and automation and how platforms are going to evolve, I think we're going to see more of this as we move into solving greater social problems. The need for collaboration is really where the whole solution stems from. you know, at the moment we're using a fintech solution because it's the very best way for us to reach people remotely and empower them, but also to enable us to comply with anti-money laundering, KYC, and really allow this to be done in a very transparent, trusted and legal way. So that, you know, fintech is the perfect solution. If we were to try to do cash handouts, that I just think that would be very problematic. So it just happens to fit the solution that we, you know, it solves the problem for us. We fit within the charity sector because within the UK, at least, we have a charitable wing. And again, that solves a problem for us. So we have a for-profit tech platform company that holds the IP for the technology, and we all get paid out of that company. And then we have a charitable wing, Esther Giving Limited. And what that does for us is put a legal wrapper around the donations. So we're able to claim gift aid on every pound donated. And we're also able to work off that gift aid, which enables us to have a revenue stream, and also enables us to market our product as a zero fee platform. So if you put a pound through Esther to get it to Joanne or to get it to someone homeless in the city, that pound will go directly to that person in need because we work off the government gift aid. So the actual charitable wing works really, really well for us, and we work together as a group, which is a very common social enterprise sort of governance for a social impact company to have a for-profit wing and a charitable wing to work in collaboration together to solve a problem. So that's kind of the charitable aspect of it. And, you know, and then we have this marketing element of it as well, where we primarily work to engage donors, right? Because if you think about it, this is a product, that's our sales pipeline. Businesses who want to give, donors who want to give in a different way. And we're always doing donor interviews with businesses who work in CSR, who want to do something different, maybe for a millennial audience. And so we have like a really strong focus on UX, user experience. How do people want to give? How do they feel? What is it they're wanting to achieve? And so as a startup, we have a lot going on, which is why I think we're both women. Like Eilish and I, we can tackle different aspects of this business, the two of us working in town, and we can get an enormous amount done. You know, we're not afraid of multitasking. We're not afraid of tackling, you know, the card solution one week and then completely swinging right over to the donor end of things and doing donor interviews, making sure that the user experience is up to speed, and then coming back and looking at the investment side of things as well. So I think, you know, maybe not all women, but particularly as mothers, you know, multitasking just kind of comes quite naturally, and changing your energy focus on a regular basis is just what we do on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, we're not afraid of bridging things across sectors because it works for what we're trying to achieve. I don't think we set out to do this on purpose. We just knew that, okay, fintech works here, let's focus on that. The charitable wing works here, it enables us to do this more efficiently, but we also need to keep a really strong, firm grip on sales and marketing as an organisation as well. So that's kind of what we do. We work across sectors. I think our big vision as we move into the next 10 years of moving out of pilot and startup and into kind of scaling and making this a much more global brand. And, you know, we want to be a city by city movement. We have big visions to be the first. I mean, I don't mind being ridiculously ambitious and then potentially falling flat on my face with this statement, but I want Esther to be the very first social impact unicorn. I think the next generation of entrepreneurs are going to be massively social impact driven. So we will see this new breed of company coming into being where social impact is at the focus of what we do. So we have high ambitions to be a global brand with an enormous amount of wealth and power and influence for social good.
Have you always been that ambitious, Carol?
Probably. I'm a little competitive. I'm a middle child, which I don't know what that says about me, but perhaps I've always had a chip on my shoulder. My brother is a year and a half older than me, and he was always very, very much stronger physically than me. And so we were actually chatting about this morning. My sister's home from London, staying with us at the minute. We were talking about, you know, how sibling relationships really shape who you become. And my brother and I had a power struggle our entire childhood. And because he was stronger than me, you know, he was able to kind of hold me down and do what big brothers do, like, you know, spit on your head and just be a ridiculous big brother. But what I was able to do was manipulate him verbally. And I think that really, like, I grew up not being afraid of tackling men who were bigger and older than me, not being afraid of being very outspoken, because I knew that if I wasn't physically strong enough to win a fight, I could find a way with how I use my words. And so, I think that relationship with my brother really shaped my my desire to be competitive and knowing what my strengths are. So I'm very happy that he bullied me when I was young.
He set you on the right track.
Yeah, he did a really good job.
Well, not tell him, but he gets all the credit.
No.
So you're a self-confessed, if not ambitious person, which I think you are saying you're ambitious, but definitely competitive.
Yeah.
How much do you value ambition in other people? Or do you think there's a place for less ambition? And I'm just thinking because, you know, sort of many years ago, you know, I was kind of in an environment where my sort of ambition was kind of like, oh, we're not really sure about that. And I was, you know, I sort of in that group of people quite uncomfortable. Yeah. And I didn't think I was a particularly ambitious person, but just had a career that I wanted to follow. So I'm just interested in your reflection, especially as this is the European Women in Payments Network, which is all about diversity as well as inclusion.
Yeah. I kind of empathize with that, Alison, as well, knowing, you know, as women, quite often ambition isn't seen as a good thing when you're young. Potentially this is going to be hard work, or you're being too bossy, or so I think, yeah, I feel that as well, coming from even my group of friends, I think, as well, who I love dearly, stepping out and owning your strengths and being okay to say, you know, I'm actually really, really good at this, but also knowing your weaknesses, this is where I'm not so good and not so strong. And I think it's possibly a Northern Irish culture thing as well, that we're not very comfortable saying, I'm actually really good at this thing and I'm going to go do it, because people then think, well, you know, what if you fail? What a deeply vulnerable thing to say about yourself, because maybe you won't make it to being a global brand, or, you know, whatever else. So I think you have to reconcile that ambition with a deep security within yourself that you may not achieve all of your own personal ambition, and being okay with that from the get-go. So I think that's the first thing about my own personal ambition, is that I very much partner within myself with being okay to fail and getting it wrong, which I have done and most likely will do. In fact, definitely will do in the journey that I have in front of me. So yes, ambition, but also a very strong happiness, comfort with failure. So that's the first thing. But I think as well, when we set out to build our team, we value diversity. We value inclusion in not just being sort of an alpha type, you know, go-getter and out there, but very much valuing the different skill sets that people have. And I know in my own life, even from my own marriage, I've been married for 12 years, and my husband is very cautious and likes to plan things, and he's the sort of person that makes lists and gets deeply uncomfortable when I change plans at the last minute. And it's been this journey for him not to have a panic attack when I just like completely rip up our plans for the weekend. So, but that works really well for me, because I know that I'm much more of a risk taker. So I tend to surround myself with people who are different than me, because that's when things get done and that's when things work at a steady pace. So my co-founder, Eilish, like when we kind of got to be friends and kind of looked at this whole venture together, she is so vastly different from me. She's very detail orientated. She will look at all of the risks. You know, she loves risk analysis, and she will spend a lot more time on a decision than I necessarily would. So we have gotten to know each other's skill sets. I know my strengths and weaknesses, and they almost parallel directly with her strengths and weaknesses. So we tend to divvy up tasks according to, right, well, I've gone ahead and done this, but I need you to look at it because I've probably missed about four things. And so, you know, you need to be aware and very cautious to hire people, to ask for help from people who are different than you are. And I am very aware of what I'm not good at. I would much rather be here with you guys, connecting, networking, getting to know people, asking for help, helping people where I can, than to be doing a VAT return, which would utterly kill me. And so, but I need people who think about the operations of the business and getting that VAT return in and making sure that we are claiming gift aid on a regular basis and what does our cash flow look like and making sure that we have the right financial projections for the next investor conversation. And so I lean quite heavily on my team for all of that good stuff. And of course we work in partnership with it, but I cannot overemphasize the importance of getting out of your own head and working with people who are dramatically different than you are for everything, for the problem you're trying to solve as a business, for how you build your team, for how you run your finances, and being okay with really good conflict in that team, taking other people's opinions on board and staying teachable. I think that, and that takes, you know, that takes practice. But I think it's the only way to do things is know that you're not perfect and that you have deep weaknesses in your character and your skill set, and allow other people to partner with you in what you're doing.
And Carol, I mean, the conflict is the bit that sort of, you know, speaks volumes to me, because, you know, we can all say we want to value diversity, inclusion, but the uncomfortable truth of that surely must be that it's going to involve conflict, because what else is diversity other than lots of conflicting and competing ideals? So how do you, and you've got a very close working relationship, I know that you've talked about your co-, but I think there's also a third team member. That's a small, cozy team. How do you deal with that?
With a lot of communication and openness on a regular basis. So, you're absolutely right. It's going to cause arguments, and it is way harder. I would say it's much more uncomfortable to work on a diverse team than it is to work on a team of people who think like you and want what you want. But there was a really brilliant TED talk, and I wish I could remember the name of the lady who did this TED talk, but she talked about the importance of healthy conflict in growing an organization, that iron sharpens iron. And if you're not hitting a roadblock in your own concepts and ideas and how you want to execute things, how you want to run your team or spend your time, then that should be an alarm bell. There should be a red flag going off, because, you know, you're not going to have a clear vision of exactly how this product is going to fit on a global scale. You need people from a global perspective. And we only have three of us employed in the team right now, which is why we value networking so much, to get other people's concepts and ideas, and tapping into diversity outside of your own team as well, who you speak to, who you listen to. But as you say, that results in conflict. We do Monday mornings, we go through the Trello board, and this just comes down to rhythms as an organization. We'll go through the Trello board and we'll look at, well, why didn't that get done? Whose responsibility is it, right? What is it a focus anymore? And that's kind of where we'll have our arguments is, you know, we make time for it on a Monday, right? We're going to do conflict, let's do it now. It's just scheduling it in and making it a normal part of culture to disagree with each other. And in fact, it's okay to do it. I expect it to happen. And we should all understand that if there isn't disagreements being verbalized on a regular basis, then it's happening somewhere else in the organization. It's happening over coffee. It's happening at the water cooler. It's happening inside someone's head as they're in the shower. They're arguing with someone subconsciously. And I think it leads to stagnation. I don't know if you've ever been there. I have been there, where I've been sat in the shower having a full-scale argument with someone in my head. So if you're not getting it out in a day-to-day way that's structured and acceptable and encouraged, I just think it leads to stagnation. It's not a good thing. So normalizing conflict as a culture, making room for it, is a really good thing to do.
Yes, the arguments that you have in the shower are always much better, much more poetic and well spoken or well articulated. Yeah,
well articulated, very well rehearsed, I think, those arguments.
Carol, our time's running short, and we want to get to the point where we can invite others to join and ask the questions too. But I have one more question for you in this session, and it's a question we asked our previous speaker as well about the Black Lives Matter movement, because it's clearly over the past few months, whilst it's been an issue for so much longer, it has clearly captured our attention, and there's been a lot of debate and discussion. And I wondered, you know, you have a small team in your business, but you're part of a bigger community. What's the impact had on you and how you've looked at things?
It's had an impact on a personal level, and I think in a strategic business level as well. So I think from a personal level, my response has certainly been one of understanding my own education on education in this space, like how little I know about the systemic racism that's happening across the globe. And so I think for me, it was looking at my own life and trying to educate myself on this, and then taking that education into conversations with my team. And I mean, for me as a parent, and I think I mentioned this a while ago, but you know, I realized that my daughter has like almost no dolls that are not white with blue eyes. And so that was the first thing that really struck me, was what am I, it's an unconscious bias, but what am I doing to frame the mind of my daughter in this way? She is growing up in a white world with white dolls and white Barbies. And even when we do colouring in, my natural bias is to lift the peach marker and draw skin, you know, in peach. And so that was my first realization, is that a lot of this is just unconscious bias on our own part, raising our children in that way. So that's the first thing that I've tried to change, is kind of including different books with different coloured people in the books and things like that, and buying her some dolls of different race. From a business perspective, we've been very aware of our move into the US at this time. So we've been in conversation with Denver about, you know, making sure that when we do reach out into the recipients and sort of identifying people onto the platform, that we are very aware of this Black Lives Matter movement, and ensuring that we aren't prejudiced in any way, and that we are listening to the community about the people that are in need. So it's been a difficult one to navigate in terms of the, because with Denver, we're looking specifically at tackling homelessness. And it does turn out that, and this is something that I wasn't even aware of, that the majority of homeless people in Denver are Black. That, you know, and this is something I noticed as well walking around New York, is that, you know, there obviously are white homeless people on the streets of New York, but so many are Black. So it has been apparent in our work in the US that it is just a systemic problem, and one that we're hoping to work on together to change. So yeah, I think personal education, parenting differently, and being very aware of inclusion when we branch out into the US, and also just asking questions, you know, being very open about not knowing very much about this, is sort of in relationship with our charity partners out there, just saying, is there anything we need to be aware of? How can we serve this community better? And trying to take their lead on it as well. We don't know what we don't know. So just being aware of that as well, moving into a new market.
Carol, thank you. That's a really honest and open answer. Thank you so much for the answers to the previous questions that I've asked.